is brought to you by Head Start Basketball.
As silly as it may sound, getting 1% better in what you do, right? Incremental upgrades in what you do. And if you can do that consistently, you're going to be a better team. And that's what I've challenged our guys with. I want them to get 1% better in five different areas. And if we can all do that, the 12 guys that are returning, that makes us 60% better.
Raul Placeres is the men's basketball head coach at Merivale College in the state of Tennessee. A 2006 Merivale graduate, Placeres worked under Merivale Wall of Fame head coach Randy Lambert for the previous eight seasons as the associate head coach before taking over the top position in 2019. In his four seasons, Placeres and the Scots have a 57-31 overall record and a 36-16 mark in conference play. That includes three consecutive regular season titles and two conference tournament championships. Placeres began his coaching career in 2005-2006 while finishing his degree at Merivale. From 2006 to 2011, Raul developed the Gatlinburg-Pittman High School basketball program into one of the top squads in Tennessee before joining the staff at Merivale in 2011. As a collegiate player, Placeres led Keystone Junior College to a Sweet 16 and NJCAA National Semifinal appearance following his freshman and sophomore campaigns. As a junior point guard, Placeres paced Merivale College in assists and led the Scots to a 23-5 record and an NCAA Sweet 16 finish. Following his senior year, he earned his second consecutive All-Great South Athletic Conference accolade while breaking the school record for assists in a game with 17 against Oglethorpe. Placeres finished his collegiate career with more than 1,100 points and more than 600 assists. Hey, Hoopheads, transform your training this May with our partners and friends at Dr. Dish Basketball. Their Dr. Dish shooting machines are undoubtedly the most advanced and user-friendly machines on the market. Get $3,000 off any commercial machine in the month of May. Learn more at drdishbasketball.com and follow their incredible content at Dr. Dish B-Ball on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube. Mention the Hoopheads podcast and save an extra $300 on the Dr. Dish Rebel, All-Star, and CT models. Visit drdishbasketball.com for details. That's a great deal, Hoopheads. Get your Dr. Dish shooting machine today.
Hi, this is Gannon Baker, and you're listening to the Hoopheads podcast.
Prepare like the pros with the all-new Fast Draw and Fast Scout. Fast Draw has been the number one play diagramming software for coaches for years. You'll quickly see why Fast Model Sports has the most compelling and intuitive basketball software out there. For a limited time, Fast Model is offering Hoopheads listeners 15% off Fast Draw and Fast Scout. Just use the code HHP15 at checkout to grab your discount, and you'll be on your way to more efficient game prep and improved communication with your team. Fast Model also has new coaching content every week on its blog, plus play and drill diagrams on its playbank. Check out the links in the show notes for more. Fast Model Sports is the best in basketball. Grab your notebook and listen to this episode with Raul Placeres, men's basketball head coach at Merivale College in the state of Tennessee. Hello and welcome to the Hoopheads podcast. It's Mike Klinzing here, maybe with or without my co-host Jason Sunkel. We're having technical difficulties trying to get Jason on, but we are here with Raul Placeres, head men's basketball coach at Merivale College in Merivale, Tennessee. Raul, welcome to the Hoopheads pod.
Hey, man, appreciate you having me on.
We are thrilled to have you on. Looking forward to diving into all the things that you've been able to do throughout your basketball life. Let's start by going back in time to when you were a kid. Tell me about some of your first experiences with the game of basketball, how you got introduced to it, and what made you fall in love with it.
Yeah, man. You know, got introduced to it at a really young age. I was about 9 years old. My parents are Cuban immigrants to this country. And so obviously the first sport was baseball. And I just really didn't like it. And my dad put the ball in my hand at 9 years old, and man, just started working. And even though he never played basketball, just taught me a lot about, just having proper discipline and, just working on your habits each and every day. And man, I was lucky enough to run into a gentleman by the name of Bill Vargas, who coached at the YMCA locally there. I'm originally from Miami, Florida. And played for him. And, you know, he really invested in me. And I was a really quiet, you know, kid at that point in my life. And he really injected in me a lot of confidence and just passion for the game. And, you know, being a point guard in those days, you know, my favorite player was Magic Johnson. And I wanted to be Magic Johnson. And Coach Bill called me Magic, you know, and it just gave me a lot of confidence, man, as a point guard to know that my coach had my back and he wanted the very best for me. And, you know, that went on to my middle school and had a great coach, Coach Long, won a middle school championship, had some great teammates, you know, got a couple of guys who are now NBA officials in the Goble brothers, Jason and John Goble. They're both in the NBA as referees, and Travaris Robinson, who's a defensive back coach at Alabama. So, you know, I played with some pretty talented guys who have done some really good things with their life. And, man, that went on to obviously high school. You know, was fortunate enough to play for a couple of college coaches, Sergio Rocco, who was a Florida, was a head coach at Florida International, been an assistant at Ole Miss, South Florida, you know, has done some really nice things in college basketball. And Mark Lieberman, who worked under Rick Pitino at one point at Louisville. So I got to play for both of those guys and also a gentleman by the name of Henry Lorenzo at Gulliver Prep. You know, I played with the late Sean Taylor in high school. We were both teammates, played for the Washington Redskins. So, man, had a really good high school career, was all city first team in Dade County, which is a pretty big deal, you know, in Miami. And, you know, just accomplished a lot as a high school basketball player and obviously gave me an opportunity to play college ball.
When you think about those early coaches that you talked about that had such a big influence on you, when you think about what they did as coaches, is there one or two things that when you think about yourself as a coach that you can kind of trace it directly back to their influence, something that you pulled from them that had an impact that you still incorporate into what you do today?
Yeah, they truly invested in me, the person, and that really stuck with me as a young man. And obviously, I've carried that on now. You know, I'm going into my 17th year in coaching, and they just invested in me, the person, and really were there for me as an adult and as a mentor, not just when I played for them, but throughout my whole life. You know, I've had my YMCA coach has come to my college games. My middle school coach still sends me postcards in the mail. You know, and I've obviously have stayed in touch with my other coaches, but I think that's, you know, it's one of those things that makes it special now that I'm doing this for a living. You know, I go back and see how much these guys poured into me, and, you know, I feel like I owe it to the game to do the same now for my players.
Does he address those cards to Magic?
Yeah, he actually got me a mug that says Magic, Coach
Magic.
That's
awesome. That's awesome. Yeah, anybody else in your life in that era call you Magic?
Well, I was a Laker fan. My dad was a Celtics fan growing up, so my dad would be calling me Magic.
Oh, man. That's rough.
But, yeah, it is a rough, you know, household because he's pulled for Larry. But, no, man, you know, why did I gravitate to Magic as a player? You know, he was a selfless guy. He poured into his teammates, and, you know, he just tried to make everyone around him better. And, you know, I think that's what a lot of my coaches did early on in my career.
As a player, what'd you do to get better? How did you work on your game? What did it look like in the summers while you were a high school or college player? How'd you go about getting better? What were you doing?
Yeah, so my upbringing is a little bit different. You know, obviously being from down south, you know, honestly in Miami back in the day when I played, there wasn't many gyms you go to and play, right? You're playing in the asphalt, you're playing outside. I'm playing with older guys. You know, that's something that you don't see as much in today's player, that you go outside and you're playing you know, in the 95 to 100 degrees, you know, weather, and yep. And you better win when you're playing against older dudes and they don't call fouls, so you got to be a little bit tougher. And you know, the things that I did, my dad was big on the details of the game, especially early on, even with not having much knowledge about the game. You know, he saw that layups are important, so we had simple, man, I got to make 10 in a row, 10 times from the right side, which was 100 right-handed layups, and 10 from the left side with my left hand, and 10 from the middle of the floor from 5 feet, and then make free throws. And we would do that religiously. And I owe my dad a lot. You know, my dad would work at a gas station from 6 a.m. to 3 o'clock in the afternoon. He'd come home, eat, take a quick little nap, and then, man, he'd go to the courts with me for an hour, hour and a half each and every day, you know, to pour into me and hopefully make me a better basketball player.
It's so different today. And this is something, Raul, that we talk about all the time on the podcast, is just the way that we grew up in the game compared to the way kids today grew up in the game, where they have, as you said, much more access to gyms. I mean, as a kid, I had little access to a gym when I was younger. And then as I got older, I had some opportunities to get into a gym as a high school player. But a lot of my formative years were spent playing outside, whether first on my driveway as like an elementary school kid. And then as I got older, the courts that were maybe a half a mile from my house, I used to ride the bike to. And then as I was able to drive, I could drive around to different playgrounds and parks. And every once in a while, I'd find my way into a gym to try to find a good run somewhere. But as you said, kids today don't play that way. You're playing AAU, you're playing on a team with kids your own age, and you're playing in a gym with mom and dad watching most likely, and you got a coach on the sideline and all that stuff. And I look at it, and there's certainly positives to the system that we have today. And yet I look back at my upbringing in the game, and it sounds like yours was a similar experience, where I just feel like all the things that I had to learn, not just as a basketball player, but just culturally of how to fit in, especially as a younger kid playing against older guys and just going and playing in different neighborhoods and against different people. And I feel like that developed me not only as a basketball player, but also as a person. And I just wonder, from your perspective, like as a coach, when you think about how you grew up in the game and how you worked on your game and how you improved and got better, how do you think about that and kind of juxtapose it against the way that the kids that you're coaching today, the way they came up in the game? And what do you think are the things that, I don't want to say are different or better or worse or whatever, but just how do you compare the players that grew up in your era versus the players that we have today, just in terms of how they kind of got to the point where they are, if that question makes any sense at all?
Yeah, no question. You know, I know exactly what you're talking about. And obviously the message that, you know, that obviously you want to be delivered from me and my experiences, right? Like, I just feel like back in our day when we were growing up, there was a lot more one-on-one. Obviously, we didn't have the social media aspect of it, where, you know, you're at the park and, you know, every kid now has a cell phone and they're videoing themselves and they're looking for highlights and things like that. I think when we grew up playing, we just played a lot more one-on-one. There was great pride in being that guy at the park that, you know, nobody could beat. You know, where I grew up, you know, you'd go to different parks, right? Like, oh, man, you're the man at Ruben Dario Park. Well, you're going to go to West End Park, you know, and you're going to see if you're right. The guy. Right. And, you know, and then the word, you know, just it was in the neighborhood, man, that guy can play, that guy can't play. And, you know, you would challenge yourself more. Right. And you don't see that interaction much with the kids today. I'm not saying it's worse today or our era was better. It was just different. But, you know, playing outside, playing in that heat, playing in the type of places that I know I played in and grew up in, it definitely made me a tougher player and made me handle adversity as I continue to get older and in the game. It made me a better player.
Obviously, you, as you said, had a really good high school career and high school experience. When you think about your decision in terms of being recruited and where you were going to go to school and thinking about maybe what you wanted to do as a career, where was your mindset at as you were looking at colleges and trying to figure out what your plan was? And then ultimately, how'd you make the decision? And then kind of what was that recruiting process like?
Yeah, for me, it was kind of difficult because, you know, you're talking about I made first team all day county in Miami, Florida, right? So that's a big deal. 10 guys got chosen, right? 10 guys got chosen from all the classifications. I'm one of those 10 guys. Well, I'm looking at the other 9 guys and they're all going Division I. I was the only guy who didn't go Division I. And, you know, and I understand it now at 18 years old. I didn't get it, right? I was barely 6 feet tall and I weighed 150 pounds soaking wet. And, you know, I look at it, you know, at that time I was like, man, what are they not seeing me? You know, I'm averaging 21 points a game and 5 assists a game and I'm a 1,000-point scorer and, you know, and I'm all state and I'm the MVP of the All-Star game and, you know, and all this stuff that you accomplish as a player. And, you know, I get it now as a coach, man. I just physically wasn't ready. And fortunately, I took a year off and just went to a junior college for a semester. And then I ended up signing with Keystone Junior College out of Pennsylvania, right there in the Pocono Mountains in La Plum, Pennsylvania, right outside of Scranton, Pennsylvania. And played for a gentleman by the name of Tommy Dempsey, who coached the head coach at Rider University and ended up finishing his career at Binghamton. And man, we went to a Final Four my first year there as a freshman, and you know, had some really good success there. I was an all-region player, and man, again, you know, I'm there after 2 years of JUCO, and I'm thinking to myself, man, I really want to prove to everybody I'm still, you know, a D1 guy. And honestly, all I had was a lot of D2s up in the Northeast, and I wanted my parents to see me play. And Barry University, a D2 back home, was really interested in me. And it came down to me and another guy, and they chose the other young man. And man, here I am. I told all those Northeast schools, you know, I'm not staying up here because I want to go back home. And I, you know, and I missed out on all those opportunities. And you know, here I am. And you know, luckily, like for all of us and a lot of our stories, you know, a good friend of mine transfers from a Division I to Maryville. He played at FIU, at Florida International. And he says, man, I love it up here. Man, you need to visit. And I kind of made the first real mature decision of my life. And I said, you know, I have nothing else to prove, but I just got to prove it to myself, you know. And I wanted to play big minutes, and I wanted to be part of a winning program. And obviously, Maryville College presented, you know, all those opportunities. And, you know, man, I don't regret it. You know, I had two great years here. I was all conference both years that I was here. Got to break a school record for assists in a game. And, you know, I ended up finishing with over 1,000 points and 600 assists for my career, and got to play a little bit of ABA basketball here locally for two teams. And man, you know, because of that decision, a lot of things have, you know, have transpired in my life that men are amazing. Met my wife, you know, I have a daughter, and got to become a high school head coach, and, you know, obviously now a college head coach as well. So, you know, it's been a great ride so far, for sure.
Hard to explain that, though, to 18-year-old you, correct?
No question. No question. There's
it's
no
like,
question about
I
that.
I remember, you know, I ended up having an opportunity to play Division I, but the offer, the place where I went, was the only offer that I had. And just like you, there were a lot of guys that I played against a lot that I thought I was at least as good as or better than, that were signing early, and then they were getting multiple offers, and then I know this guy's going here, this guy's going there, and I'm looking around going, I'm better than this dude, and I'm better than this guy. And you know, you just, and it, so it's funny now, Raul, because my kids, I have one daughter who just finished her freshman year in college. I'm going to pick her up tomorrow, and then my son is a high school junior, and then I have a seventh grader. And so the two older ones are kind of, you know, obviously the one already made a college decision, and then my son will eventually have one here. And you go through the process of trying to help them figure out like how to pick a school. And I'm like, I don't know. I have nothing. I mean, I didn't look at anything besides bad, you know, like, hey, I had one Division I scholarship offer. Guess what? That's where I was going to go and see what I could make out of it. And so I didn't care about the campus or the majors classes.
Yeah,
right.
You know, no question. And a lot of it too, like, you know, my parents not really knowing the college process, honestly,
for sure,
to be quite frankly with you. You know, we weren't very well educated in the college process. And, you know, heck, you're thinking about, you know, I went from Miami to Scranton, Pennsylvania. You know,
yeah,
I
had never been, how that
you know, I had a friend of mine who played with me in high school, ended up at University of Scranton. And he told the guy, hey, man, there's this guy who's I played with back home really good. Like, he just wants to play. And they reached out to me. And, you know, I never visited Keystone. I actually flew into the wrong airport. I was supposed to fly into to Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania, and I flew into Allentown.
That's
and
awesome.
I remember the drive. Like, you know, I'm from a big city, and I'm driving down. I'm like, man, there's not a fast food restaurant in a 50-minute window here, you know? It was an Amish kind of town. So I'm seeing, you know, horses and buggies, and I'm like, what and where am I? And man, but what a great experience. Had some unbelievable professors there who took care of me, and you know, obviously won a lot, and you know, really enjoyed my time there. And then, like I said, you know, coming to Maryville. But back to your point of, man, I was just physically wasn't ready, and that's something that now as an adult and as a college coach I totally understand. And you know, I will say that by the time I think I was a junior at Maryville, and obviously entering my senior year, that I had finally grown into my body. And, you know, if I would have had that body as a high school senior, definitely probably would have played at a higher level. But again, man, you know, the reason I am where I am, there was a reason for it. And, you know, I'm just really thankful for all those opportunities.
You would have been in the portal, man.
No question. Trying to get a deal with Papa John's or something.
You and 2,000 other guys all would have been in the portal trying to get a good NIL deal and get somewhere. No, so it's crazy, man. That thing's going to hopefully work itself out and settle. That's a whole nother conversation as we go forward. But man, so as you're at Maryville and you're obviously having an opportunity to, as you said, just getting to play and wanting to be on the floor and impact winning, and you obviously did a lot of that. What were you thinking about in terms of, was coaching at all on your radar at this point, or what were you thinking career-wise, or were you still just focused on, I'm a basketball player and I'm going to school, but man, I want to kind of try to continue to play?
No, man, you know, I graduated, I met my wife my last semester of school, and you know, that definitely deterred my vision of, I thought I was going to go back home, and I ended up staying here. She's actually an Ohio girl. I know you're from Ohio. Yeah, she's from Aurora right there, but I think you played at Kent State, didn't you?
So that's right down the road.
Yeah, so she's an Aurora girl, and you know, I met her and, you know, obviously fell in love and had opportunities to go and play in Ulm, Germany. You'll probably remember this name, big time D3 guy, Jeff Gibbs played for Ulm, and Lee Humphrey, who played at Florida. But at the time, they were just a second division team, so they weren't paying much money. And man, it was kind of one of those things in life where I had this opportunity to make about $800 a month, and my wife obviously wanted me to take it, right? At the time, my girlfriend, you know, let's go experience the world, and you know, let's go to a different part. And man, I got offered the school system job. I was a history major, and you know, I knew I wanted to coach at some point. And man, I just, you know, I couldn't pass it up. I thought it was a great opportunity. Working half the time as a translator, I speak Spanish. And working as a translator for the school system, being a history teacher the other half of the day, and then being a freshman and JV coach. You know, I thought I was on top of the world at 23 years old. And, you know, those doors opened up for me. But to answer your question, I did. I've always wanted to coach, you know, being a point guard. In essence, I've been coaching since I was 10 years old on the floor. Right. So that was, for me, it was a really natural progression to go into this career. So really thankful for the opportunities that have been presented to me.
All right. So what'd you like about coaching at the high school level? Cause I know you did that for a bunch of years before you get back into the college game.
I love the purity of it. You know, I started at a really young age. You know, that first year I coached freshman JV, the varsity coach ends up leaving and they offer me the job at 24 years old. So I'm a 24 year old kid, you know, trying to coach a high school program who's not been very good. And, you know, the first thing that I changed, I felt like, man, you know, all these guys are wearing different jerseys and, you know, there's not much, you know, cohesion between them. And, you know, I wanted them to look good first. And then when they started looking good, they started feeling good. And you know how that goes. And then we started playing good. And, man, those 4 years really helped me. I'm eternally thankful for the school system director who gave me that opportunity and the principal at the time, you know, to give a 24-year-old, you know, a kid. I was a kid to be coaching 18-year-old young men without really much experience, right, as a head coach. It made me grow up really fast. And, man, we turned it around and we won more games each and every year. We went from 16 to 18 to 22 to 24 and with district championships and, you know, being ranked in the, you know, top two in the state my last 2 years. And man, it again made me really grow up. But I look back at it now as a 41-year-old college head coach and, you know, I'm like, man, what was I doing? Like, what was I thinking? it was, you know, the purity of it. Just, you know, the pep rallies, you know, where it's a fun environment. You know, once we get into the college game, you know, it becomes in some regards a job, you know, and you lose a little bit of that at the college level. But man, I enjoyed my time. Those 5 years, that first year as a freshman and JV coach, and then the 4 years as a head coach were awesome for me and my family at the time.
So were you teaching during that time too?
So I quickly found out that that's somewhere where I did not want to be in, was in the classroom. And thankfully, they named me the translator for the entire school system. So
gotcha.
I was taking care of the entire school system, the Hispanic population up in the Sevier County area. It's the Gallenberg Pigeon Forge area here in Tennessee, really grew. and they needed somebody to be full time. And, you know, and that helped me because here in Tennessee, fourth block, you can actually start practicing. And so it was, you know, I was practicing our team sometimes 1:30, 2 o'clock. And, you know, that was a great advantage to my job. And obviously being recently married to spend time with my wife and obviously my daughter.
Yeah, it's awesome. I mean, to be able to have that schedule. It's interesting just how different the rules are from state to state in terms of when you can practice. And I know there's multiple states that have that athletic block built into the school day. And then there's other states where coaches can't even touch players at all during the off season. And it's crazy how many different rules there are. It feels like that's something that the National Federation should step in and try to figure it out.
and kind of even it out.
Yeah, make the rules the same everywhere. It just seems like if you could put everybody on an even playing field, it would just make more sense from a lot of different perspectives. But who knows? That's probably never going to happen just because there's so many different hands in the cookie jar when it comes to all that stuff. So remains to be seen. When you think about your time there as a high school coach, you get that head coaching job really early. Like you said, you're still a kid, age 24. Let's talk about what were you good at right from the start? Like, what's something about coaching that you took to right away? And then after you answer that, let's flip it around and say, what's something that when you look back, you're like, God, I was horrible at that particular aspect of it, now looking back from the perspective that you have now. So something that you were really good at that you took to naturally, and then maybe something that you really had to work to develop over the course of time.
Yeah, I think, you know, my players have always said, you know, I'm a player's coach, you know, and I kind of understood what that meant because obviously I played, right? And I wanted my guys to play with that freedom and understand that, you know, I'm really going to get on your tail during practice, but once the game comes, you know, I really want you to play free, right? You know, and you hear that a lot, right? Playing free and loose, but at the same time being disciplined. I just thought, you know, I'm a real passionate guy. You know, I wear it on my sleeve. So I think, you know, just being a player's coach, being extremely passionate, and then being, you know, right out of the game, you know, the guys could see, and I was still in really good shape. I was playing in the ABA at the time because the local team, I would play on the weekends. So the kids would actually come and see me play.
That's cool. That's very cool.
And there was a league here. They called it the Rocky Top League. And so it was all the Tennessee guys, NBA guys would come back and play. Like CJ Watson would come back and play from Tennessee. And that was the Bruce Pearl era here. So there was a lot of good players here in Tennessee. And so it was all the local college players, guys that are playing overseas, you know, and semi-pro. And so, you know, they would come back and see me play. So obviously I gained their respect from the start, right? Like coaches not only can coach, you know, coach, but he can play a little bit,
right,
you know?
Right, exactly. And, that always helps.
Yeah, that helps. And you know, so I obviously got their respect really early on, especially for a young coach like I was at the time. But, you know, looking back at it now, things that I could have improved in, you know, very set oriented at the time, you know, you're coaching different. I just wanted to get the ball in my best player's hands, you know, and, you know, although I gave them freedom, I could have been a little bit more free, right? And so I look back at it now, and that's probably something I would change. And also, you know, I had just finished playing college, and, you know, the preparation. You know, I played for a Division III coaching legend, right? Guys won over 700 games and been to 20 NCAA tournaments, and he's in the Tennessee State Hall of Fame. And, you know, I think I went overboard at times in how to, you know, getting my guys prepared for a game, you know, and it's high school, you know? And but you know, I always thought, you know, preparation was really, really important. And you know, like I shared with my guys at the time, and I was just trying to teach them things in order for them to be ready for the next step, was how important preparing for a game was, you know? And, you know, we talked about preparation with Trump pressure and it fueled confidence and it becomes your separation, right? And I would say, you know, I would say these things and these guys are 14, 15 years old. You know what I mean? So, you know, a little bit sometimes maybe information overload, you know? But, you know, I think now as they're adults and they're coming to now see me coach in college and we stayed in touch with a lot of those guys, they see it now, right? What I was trying to do with them at that point in their lives.
It's interesting when you think about prep work for high school, because I know that there's times where you look at it and you say, okay, I want my team to be as prepared as possible. And then I know, like when I was coaching at the high school level, and I was an assistant with the same guy who was the head coach, and he and I coached together for like 12 or 13 years before my kids were born, and I kind of stepped away. But I know he and I would talk a lot about, well, how much do we give these guys in terms of prep for a particular opponent? We're like, half the time they can't even remember what we're doing, let alone we're gonna give them and try to show them what the other team's doing and give them this long scouting report. And I think over the course of time, sounds like you probably came to the same realization that you kind of have to pick and choose and understand what your team is capable of processing and what's going to benefit them, right? Because ultimately, whatever you give them in terms of prep has to be something that's going to make them better
when game night comes.
And you can, as you said, you can totally overkill that really easy.
Yeah. And one of the things, you know, now thinking about that era of my coaching career, like, you know, we were 99% man-to-man in college, right? So I took that same mentality to the high school game. You know, by year three of me being a head coach, the officials weren't as good as the college game is. Yep. And you want your best players to stay in the game. So I started playing more zone, right? You know, and maybe trapping off the zone a little bit more and to be able to use our length and our size to our advantage while keeping my better players for most of the game, right? And so that kind of started changing my philosophy on how I needed to approach the high school game from my first couple of years to my last 2 years there at the high school.
All right. So during that era, are you kind of set on the fact that, hey, I want to stay in the high school game? Was the college game something that you were always kind of looking at out of the side of your eye? Just where were you in terms of your thought process?
Yeah. I, really lucky, right? At 24 years old to be a head coach in high school. Without no head coaching experience, you know, that's, you know, what a blessing that was for me, right, in my development. But, yeah, I had the ambition of being a college coach. And, you know, the call came from my coach, Coach Randy Lambert, who was the head coach here for 39 years. And obviously I mentioned some of his, you know, impressive accolades throughout his career. But, you know, he called me and said, he calls me Big. He said, hey, Big, you know, I think I'm going to retire here in the next 4 years. I'd love for you to come and help me and hopefully be the next guy. And, you know, I'm thinking to myself, man, I'm 27, four more years, 31, high, you know, college head coach. Here we go, you know.
And, right, yeah.
Those four years turned into 8 years because we won a lot. But, you know, man, but you know, again, you know, I'm a believer and everything comes in God's timing. And just very fortunate those 8 years that I spent with him because – he gave me a lot of autonomy in the program. And, you know, I was basically another head coach. And that really prepared me, you know, for what has become my job as a head coach now for the last 4 years. You know, I'm not the head coach I am today without, you know, him giving me all those freedoms as a coach and, you know, and liberties to do, you know, what I saw fit for the program. So, once that opportunity came in, I took it and I was still working for the school system at the time. So, you know, I'm talking, you're working full time from, you know, 7 a.m. to about 3 o'clock and then go to practice and recruit and do all the things like our normal head coach would do. But, you know, that's what needs to be done in order to have an opportunity to be a head coach in college. So I definitely took that opportunity and made the best of it.
What was it like going from... And obviously, it wasn't a direct line from you being a player underneath him to coaching with him. But still, there's that separation between player and coach. And now you're kind of bridging that gap. And you're going from, I played for this guy, to now I'm his colleague. We're working together. And we're on the same coaching staff. What was that transition like? Was it super easy because of the relationship you guys already had? Was there some momentary adjustments where you kind of had to step back and realize, okay, now I have to look at this guy in a different way? Or just what was that process like for you?
Yeah, I think, you know, a couple of different things. I think the, you know, the relationship of being his point guard, and we had a great relationship as player coach during my time. And but I also saw the game differently, right? And one of the things that I give coach credit for is that he always let me speak my mind, right? It doesn't mean, you know, and I share this with a lot of young assistant coaches, like, your job is to bring as much information to your head coach as possible. What if your coach decides to take it or not? You know, that's not up to you, you know, and your feelings can't get hurt or you can't feel some type of way, right? Like, yeah, that is your job. And coach gave me that freedom to, hey, man, you bring me as much info as possible. And, you know, and I'm going to listen to it. And a lot of it he took, and a lot of it he didn't, right? But our relationship was great. And towards, you know, the later part of his career there, you know, it was a good balance. You know, I was a young guy who was really ready for the opportunity. And, you know, he was, you know, on his way out, but still with obviously a lot of wisdom and knowledge and love for the game. But it was just a good combination of young and old to continue to still do the job at a really high level.
During that time, so during those 8 years, as you're obviously, you thought it was going to be four, ended up being eight, but obviously you have it in the back of your mind that at some point you're going to have the opportunity to take over as the head coach. What are you doing during that time? Obviously you're learning from Coach Lambert there, and you're paying attention and watching what he does. But what else are you doing to try to improve yourself as a coach? Where are you going? Are you talking to other mentors, other coaches from other programs? Are you doing a lot of film study, reading? Just what was your process for improving as a coach?
All those things, man. Like, you know, you've never arrived, right? And we hear that a lot. That's probably a cliche saying, but it's the absolute truth. You have never arrived, and you must continue to get better. And you know, towards the last 2 years, I knew that for sure I was going to become the head coach. You know, they had named me the coach in waiting, which was great, you know, because I knew, you know, hey, in about 9 months in that last year, you know, it's going to be my show, you know. And right. That gave me a great opportunity, you know, and the college handled it great, you know. You know, again, very fortunate because I started getting ready 2 years to the date that I was named the head coach, right? So, you know, just note taking, watching film, thinking about the things I wanted to do, get ready for things I was going to change within the program, things that I was going to keep. And, you know, just that process of getting ready for the moment. And all the things you talked about, from reading articles to watching other teams play to keeping plays that I liked, you know, in the playbook to thoughts and processes that I wanted to implement with my program once I became the head coach. So, you know, just doing my due diligence as a coach to get ready for my moment.
When that moment comes, you're in kind of an interesting situation because you have a guy who's been there for a long time, who's won a lot of games, and the program's obviously been very successful. And yet you're different person, different ideas, different thoughts. And even though you've kind of grown up in the game underneath him, there's obviously ideas and things that you're bringing to the table that you want to change or that you want to do differently. So how do you make that happen without making it, oh, he was doing it this way and it's wrong? How do you kind of ease that tension, so to speak, to make sure that you can kind of put your stamp on the program and yet not have everybody feel like, man, what's Raul doing? He's coming in and just revamping this whole thing,
yeah,
even though we've had a tremendous amount of success.
Oh, that's a great point you made, because I think a lot of young coaches make that mistake. And it doesn't matter what level, right, where you replace a middle school coaching legend or a high school coach legend or in my case, a college legend at the Division III level, right? And I always praise Coach in everything that he's done, because he, you know, he took a program basically from scratch and made it a nationally recognized program. And I learned that, you know, a long time ago. My mother taught me that at a very young age. You know, she was extremely selfless, and it was never about her. It was always about me, my sister, my brother, and our family. You know, it's about the program, man. And I want to leave this program, if I do leave it one day, better than I found it. And, you know, I knew I had an enormous responsibility to uphold the culture that Coach had created for close to 40, you know, four decades of basketball. And it was not for me to diminish anything that he did. My job is to elevate everything that he has done. So that was kind of my approach. But I think a lot of young coaches go about it in the wrong way, because you want to put your stamp and you know, and you're looking to the program. And I think that happens organically with hard work and preparation and bringing in the right type of, you know, character kids into a program.
When you think back to the first few months on the job, what were some of the things that you felt like you had to do to establish who you were as a head coach and what you wanted the program to be? Do you remember some of the action steps that you took early on?
Yeah, you know, it was, you know, the sucker was really smart because he retired and left me one senior and 12 freshmen. All right.
Sure, there you go.
You know,
he knew the year to get out.
So, you know, that senior class, you know, they won close to 90 games in 4 years. And we went to the NCAA tournament 2 times and won 3 regular season titles. That was a great senior class. You know, and I was starting from scratch. And to be honest with you, you know, we've had a lot of success here in the last 4 years. But, you know, I lost my first 9 games, man. And it couldn't have gone any worse for me, right, at the time. But, again, I'm a believer, man, and everything happens for a reason. And it made me a better coach because, you know, I'm a young coach. I'm replacing this legend. Everybody's looking, man, is this guy ever going to win a game, right? And, you know, and I'm talking about the worst of the worst, buzzer beaters from half court, one hand. I think I lost like 3 games by 1 point. Like everything that could go wrong to start a career went wrong. Man, but I remember I became really good friends with Paul Biancardi during that time. I coached a big-time AAU team, B-Maze Elite, during that time. And I remember Paul texting me and saying, hey, man, the best thing that can happen to you in your career is to go through some adversity. Because if you're trying to climb the ladder in this profession, you know, athletic directors, people that are in charge are going to see, well, how did this guy handle adversity, right? And that's what happens with a lot of coaching positions, right? A lot of guys get hired from being an assistant coach, but they've never really experienced any type of personal adversity as a coach, right? You go from a winning program and here's the job, right? And that was a great learning lesson for me that I thought everything we had done, you know, as a player there and my time with coach, that it was going to work. And it was just a different cast of players and I needed to change. And I have never worked as hard as I did in that second half of the season to definitely turn it around. And, you know, fortunately, man, we did. Those first couple of months was just, you know, trying to get 12 freshmen to understand what it took, right? And at a high level, playing a really tough schedule. And, you know, we just couldn't figure it out early on, but it was just a matter of time. Before stuff really started to click. But that was kind of my first couple of months on the job were obviously extremely difficult. As the second half of the season started, you know, we obviously had a winning record going forward. And, you know, from that point on, man, we've done pretty well since that first year. So, it was just a matter of that early stage of just getting guys to understand what the culture was about and how we needed to go about it.
What did those conversations look like? Because this is something that I think is interesting and relevant to a lot of coaches, because a lot of times when somebody's a first-year head coach, and I don't care whether it's the high school or college level, not everybody gets that prime job or they're stepping into a winning program. Lots of coaches end up getting their first experience with a program that needs to be turned around, which oftentimes means you lose more than you win in your first season. And so everybody comes into their job after they get hired for the first time and your record's still 0-0. And you preach and talk about all the things that the program's going to be about. And there's lots of excitement because it's a new coach and the players are ready to go and whatever the message is, what it is. And then all of a sudden you start 0-9. And now all of a sudden that message that sounded pretty good at 0-0, when you're 0-9, it doesn't necessarily sound as good. So how did you talk to your players during that time to make sure that they understood that it was about the process of what you guys were going through and that they kind of needed to just stick with it in order to be able to get over the hump so they could start winning games? But that's sometimes a hard sell. So yeah, what do you remember about those conversations?
No, I'll give you an example. I met with Josh Schertz, who was a fantastic coach at Lincoln Memorial for a decade plus, and now he's the head coach at Indiana State. I met with him before I got my year started, and this has always resonated with me, and I used it with that team, and I've always used it with every team that I've coached since. You know, there's 5 business cycles, right? There's the birth, the growth, the plateau, you know, the decline, and the death of a company, right? And in anything that you do, you must maintain yourself in the growth phase, and that's what I preached. And I didn't deviate from that. And I think as I've gotten now going into my 4th year as a head coach, the message has to be very clear to your guys. And if it's clear, you know, there are going to be bumps along the road, right? But as long as the message is clear, everybody knows what we're trying to accomplish and what we're trying to seek as a team. And that was my selling point to them going through those tough times was, hey, man, this is all about growth and this is part of the process. And, you know, the ones that, you know, and I remember saying that to this day, we were in a film room and I said, the guys that stay with me and they, you know, you're going to be champions. And, you know, the ones that did have experienced five different championships since that time, you know, and that's part of it, man. In order to go about it, you know, and find the winning joy, right? You got to go through some tough times, and those tough times definitely made me a better coach and made our players much better players.
In terms of your philosophy, offensively and defensively, as a head coach, because you were already in the program and you were stepping in as opposed to going to a completely new environment, did you have a pretty good feel for obviously the personnel coming back? And as you said, you come in and you kind of got a new group and that group of seniors had graduated, but you had a much better feel for what the program was and what you could do there potentially than you would as an outsider coming into a new program. So how set were you on the way you wanted to play both offensively and defensively as a head coach? And did that change when you actually sat in the head coaching chair?
You know, again, the luxury of that idea I was going to be the head coach, you know, I was recruiting the players that I wanted in the program. And I went with a very athletic mindset because I knew that's what we needed to be really successful in our league. And I'll tell you one quick lesson I learned to never devalue the value of having shooters. We were extremely athletic.
We played Transylvania. We opened up with a scrimmage with them and we beat them at home. And I'm thinking to myself, wow, man, like, you know, we actually got something here. And then I take nine freshmen. I was playing nine freshmen and one senior at the time. And we go to MTSU, Conference USA, big time program. And we're down, I believe, like 2 or 3 points at the half. And I'm looking at my assistant and I'm saying, hey, man, like, we got something here, you know? And, you know, we took the whole at the time we had a JV program. So I let everybody play. And they obviously got out of hand in the second half. But I said, man, we got something here. You know, we just got to continue to develop it, you know. And then one thing after another, like I shared with you in those first nine games, you know, a bunch of, you know, really close losses and, you know, buzzer beaters and all that. But I knew that the talent level was there, that we had the makings of a championship caliber team. And, you know, like I shared, I looked at them all in the eye and I said, hey, man, those who stick with it and stay with me and believe, you know, in the process, you're going to be champions. And, man, it happened the next year and we've been doing it now for the last 3 years.
Tell me a little bit about your recruiting process, how you go about just getting started, putting together your initial list of players that you want to check out, that you want to go look at, and then how you over time narrow that funnel down to who you bring on campus to come and visit, and then how ultimately you make your choices about who you want to bring in and who's going to be a part of your program.
You know, a lot of the coaches, great coaches you've had on your podcast, you know, a lot of similar things, you know, looking at skill set. I'm big on skill. I'm big on feel. And we got three simple little boxes you have to check. And the first two are non-negotiables. You got to be a great teammate. You know, I know those things sound very cliche-ish in our world, but it's the absolute truth, man. If you can't be a great teammate, you know, you're not going to be a great basketball team. I'm a firm believer in that. You got to have a competitive spirit about you in everything that you do. And, you know, we're looking at that. How competitive are you, as a ball player? You know, are you only your front running when you're up, you know, you're up and defending and, you know, with a lot of energy, or are you consistently that way in a game? And then, you know, lastly, because you're watching them in AAU, you're watching them at the high school with their high school teams, when their opportunity is presented, do they produce? And that's how we, you know, that's our recruiting. That's how we recruit, but that's also how we deal with our guys. The first two are non-negotiables. You got to be competitive. You got to be a heck of a teammate. And then once, you know, myself and my staff decide that it's your opportunity, you got to produce. And that's the way we go about our recruiting and the way we go about our program.
How do you define a great teammate? What does that mean to you?
Man, you know, somebody comes off the floor. You know, we're very traditional in that sense when you watch us play. You know, we all stand up. You know, we all cheer for our guy. When we go into the game, we got a towel in our hand to make sure that we got the matchup when we go back into the game. You know, we go into the game. We're kind of huddled up during a timeout. We jog off the floor, whether we're up, down, it doesn't matter. At halftime, we jog off the floor when the game is over. You know, we're on the floor at exactly 60 minutes. Everybody's shirt tails tucked in to stretch and get ready to play a basketball game and to hopefully play it at a really high level. You know, a great teammate is a guy who just doesn't come to the gym and works with, you know, works on his skills by himself, but he's wanting to bring somebody along with him. Right. And, you know, I can go on and on about different things that we look at great teammates, but that gives you a little bit of an example of what, you know, we look for in a guy, you know, a great teammate. You know, how do you deal with pick up two fouls in a high school game and most high school coaches bench a guy, right? You know, I'm not of that philosophy. I'm going to play the guy, right? And trust that he understands what he needs to do on the floor. And, you know, how do you go about that? Are you continuing to cheer on your teammates, or are you lounging back in a chair and not being attentive to the game and not being attentive in the huddles? You know, also being a great teammate, you know, goes to family. You know, how do you treat your mother and father after the game? I look at that type of stuff. How do you treat your mother and father on the recruiting visit when we're eating lunch together? You know, if someone who disrespects their mother in front of me, you're more than likely not going to have a real good relationship with me, you know, if you come to school. Right. And so I'm looking at all that type of stuff. And obviously the other two components of being competitive and obviously producing at a high level when your opportunity is given.
How much of that at this point is player enforced, for lack of a better way of saying it? In other words, when you first got the job, obviously there's some teaching that has to go on, and you, I'm sure, had already had that established as, you know, with your previous staff. But now as you take over the head coaching job, how much of that now is just, hey, the older guys, the veterans who have been in the program, hey man, this is the way we do things, and really coach doesn't have to say a whole lot? Where are you in that process?
Yeah, we've been very lucky. You know, we ended up getting two Division I transfers here the last 3 years, and those guys have been phenomenal. Our best player, he was named an All-American this past year, and Miles Raznick, you know, one of the best players I've ever coached at any level. And you know, he leads by example, and the guys see it, right? He's always in the weight room. He's always working on his game. He's very attentive in film room. He's always on time. He's a great student. So when your best player can also be the best person on your team, I think, you know, you create a great environment for great things to happen. And, you know, to your point, yeah, it is really player led, honestly. You know, I talk about it in our introductory meeting to start the year. It's very simple, right? It's not a tricky mathematical equation, right? It's real simple, man. Like, these are the things I'm asking you to do. And once you are given the opportunity to play, you got to produce, because that's how the real world works, right? Like, if you don't produce at a certain job, they're going to go get someone else who can do the job and hopefully do it better. And you know, we're trying to teach these life lessons through a game. And I think that's a very simplistic way to teach it to young, you know, 18 or 21 year olds.
Your first impression is everything when applying for a new coaching job. A professional coaching portfolio is the tool that highlights your coaching achievements and philosophies, and most of all, helps separate you and your abilities from the other applicants. The Coaching Portfolio Guide is an instructional membership-based website that helps you develop a personalized portfolio. Each section of the Portfolio Guide provides detailed instructions on how to organize your portfolio in a professional manner. The guide also provides sample documents for each section of your portfolio that you can copy, modify, and add to your personal portfolio. As a Hoopheads Pod listener, you can get your Coaching Portfolio Guide for just $25. Visit coachingportfolioguide.com/hoopheads to learn more. When you think about developing a leader like that, is that something that you think the kid comes in with? And then how do you go about developing those leadership skills that you see in players to make sure that you have the kind of program that, as you said, is player led? How do you give kids space to be able to grow as leaders within the program?
Yeah, man. So, you know,
I'll give you an example. In our meetings, I'm very direct and to the point with our guys. You know, I'm always speaking the facts and the truth with them. You know, I'm always speaking to them with respect and empathy with what they're dealing with. But I also allow them to vent and share with me what they're seeing, how they're feeling, how the process is going for them. So you know, it's I deal in a lot of truth and all the great programs. I think we all, you know, we all kind of share those things, right? Where truth is a big part of what we do. You know, I heard this was probably a year ago. You had, you know, Coach Merkel on from Randolph-Macon, won national championship. And I think their phrase is truth over harmony, I think is what he talks about.
Yep, that's right.
And you know, I feel it. You know, when I heard him talking about it, I felt it because that's who we are. You know, the truth will always be the key for growth to take place. And again, we always talk about growth. You know, I'm always, that's a word they tell you. They're sick and tired of me saying it because I talk about it all the time, you know, and I'm going to invest in them, you know, and that's what they know, that I'm going to invest my heart, my soul, everything that I have into them. I expect the same thing in return. I think when you do that, growth, naturally happens. And then the leadership part comes with that, right? Because now, you know, you're empowered, you know, by your coach, you know, because he's giving you the freedom and this is your team. You know, this is what you need to do in order to bring these guys along and help us become a better team. So, you know, just giving them the confidence that I believe in them, that I'm hearing them, but that we do that through truth. And that's how we go about it.
Talk about how that plays into the offseason, because as we've talked about numerous times with a bunch of guys who coach at the D3 level, the offseason is a time where if you're a Division I coach, you got tons of access to your players. I might argue too much access to your players. Whereas at the Division III level, now you guys are finally getting to 8 days. And I know everybody's super excited about, hey, what are we going to do with this 8 days and how are we going to make this, maximize it? And everybody has kind of a different thought on that. And we can get yours in a second. But just when you think about developing the leaders in terms of your players and making sure that everybody in your program, all your guys are getting their off-season work and doing what they need to do when you can't be the guy there with them all the time. It has to come from the leaders within the program. So how does that play into kind of how you go about talking about the off-season with everybody on your roster and just go through that process with me?
Yeah. So first of all, again, very fortunate. We have a strength coach at our level. I can't say many, you know, some programs have that, but that is not the grand majority of college programs in Division III have a strength coach, right? And so, our strength coach deals with the physical piece in the preseason, in the postseason, in the summer. So that helps Coach and I with that part of the development of the player. But I'll give you an example of what we're doing this summer. So the returning players, I got 12 guys returning on from this past year's team, and they vote for two guys, you know, who do you think two captains are returning, right? And then, you know, obviously you get different votes and stuff like that. And, you know, we have a roster now of close to 20 guys coming back with the freshmen that we signed. I basically appoint a captain, four guys to five guys, right? And they are in charge of them all summer in regards to checking up on, you know, are you doing the workouts that we send home? Are you following the weight and conditioning program? You know, I give them three drills that they need to consistently work on, because I will see when we get back on campus if you can pass those drills that we did, you know, and especially now with the NCAA passing the we're going to get 8 days before October 15th. You know, that definitely helps us a bunch. But, you know, I do that because the group is now responsible and we're holding them accountable, but I'm also holding accountable one guy for the group, right? So we all feel like we're part of this, and you don't want to let your group leader down. And, you know, obviously you don't want to let your team down. You know, we partner them up, man, throughout the year. You know, they come in and they work on their game 2 to 3 times a week before we can get started October 15th. But they have a guy typically plays the same position. And they're working, you know, every single day. And we create that structure for them as their coaches.
I love that idea of the small group. To me, that makes a ton of sense, because now you kind of set up these individual, whatever you want to call them, group squads that, as you said, not only now are they don't want to let down the greater entire team, but now you're talking about you're responsible for this small group of guys in your little pod, and you don't want to let down the leader of your group. And to me, it just is another whole layer of accountability and just a way to make sure that they're on track and they're doing what they're supposed to be doing. And as you said, it's a way to also empower. It's not just one leader. Now you have multiple leaders on the team, right? And that's what I think as coaches, you always want to do. Like we always talk about, hey, like, yeah, we might have a captain, but everybody can lead. And I think a lot of times coaches will say that, but they don't often give kids the space to be able to lead. So they might say, hey, we need more leadership, but then where does that leadership opportunity come from? And I think that by doing this, you're giving way more opportunity for kids to be able to assume that leadership role and start to take that on. And again, as you well know, talking about growth, that it's a process, right? Becoming a leader. It's not like suddenly you're like, hey, Raul, you're a leader, man. And now you've got it all figured out. Like that's not how it works. And so you got to continue to give kids more and more responsibility. And as you give them more responsibility, they take that on, they grow, they improve as leaders. And that to me, again, is what it's all about. You said it earlier, using the game of basketball to teach those life lessons that are going to impact them, not just when they're 18, 19, 20 years old, but when they're 30 or 40 or 50 years old. Hopefully those lessons that they learned when they're playing for you are lessons that they're going to take with them throughout their life.
Being comfortable, being uncomfortable. And that's part of being a leader. And, you know, we have this phrase, and I don't know who I took this from, but, you know, with all this stuff during the summer, you know, it's turning a to-do list to a must-do list, right? Yep. And that's we got to do that. You know, that might have been Kevin Eastman, you know, with his book, The Best, you know, How the Best Are the Best.
That's a great book, man.
Yeah, man, it's fantastic. Oh. But I think that's from the book. And you know, and I've taken that, right? Like, you know, man, we got to get some stuff done. If we want to be the type of team that we want to be, you know, when you're in that huddle and it's a 2-point ball game and you're looking at each other's eyes and we're talking about, hey, we need to stop. Man, did we work harder than these guys on the other side? You know, are we going to earn this victory? And, you know, I think those are the moments and why I'm doing this group thing, because now they can all look and say, hey, man, we've busted our tail all summer long for these moments. Right. And you know, again, empowering, it's part of their experience. You know, it's like I tell the parents, man, I'm never going to be able to take the place of their mother and father, but I'm definitely going to build on the foundation that they have set for their children. Right. And my job as their head coach is to continue to empower them so, you know, they can be very successful in the most important game, right? In the game of life. And that's really, really important to me.
All right, let's talk about where you are right now in the calendar. As we talked about, I think before we started recording, you got kids that are finishing school, so you're just kind of waiting on grades right now. But as a Division III head coach, school's out, players went home. What's Raul doing day to day during the month of May?
Raul is trying to get better because I can't get complacent because we have had success the last 3 years. You know, we're coming back off of another regular season and conference tournament championship. I'm just trying to get better each and every day. I'm listening to podcasts. I'm watching film on Synergy. You know, incremental little changes here and there in regards to our defense and offense to make us a little bit better next year. You know, picking other coaches' brains. Also getting ready for my camp. I have a big team camp. We have over 80 something teams, high school teams coming at the end of the month here in May, and then the first couple of days in June. And then I have a little kids camp 2 weeks after that. We typically get about 150, 160 little kids, and I'd really enjoy that. You know, I treat it like an old school camp. You know, you get dropped off at 7:30, camp starts at 9, and we go all the way to 5. And man, we have a great time with that. Those are the same little kids that come to our games. You know, we use our players, you know, our freshmen, we get them all together and they work camp. You know, I use those 4 days of camp to eat dinner with them every single night and talk about a different subject, you know, a different topic that they're going to encounter as first year students in college. And, you know, it gave me great time to spend time with those young guys that are coming in and incorporating the guys that are returning with the new guys. And that's what I'm doing, man. I'm just, again, like, if you want to be a great coach, you got to be a life learner. You've never figured it out. You need to continue to grow and learn. And that's what I'm trying to do because, you know, there's no such thing. I truly believe that there's no such thing as a finish line. When you're a true competitor and you're trying to make, you know, become the best you can possibly become, the finish line just gets pushed further and further, right? And that's what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to push that finish line further and further, so I can continue to work and work harder to continue to attain goals.
Do you have a team or a coach or an action or something that you're watching on Synergy? Is there something you're kind of dialed in on right now?
And I'm not a big seeker guy. I loved what UConn did with their post player. We got a really dominant big coming in as a freshman that I really, really like, you know, 6'9", 270-pound kid that, you know, we want to create some space for him inside. You know, I returned four of my five starters. You know, I think we'll have a pretty good chance to be pretty good again next year. And, you know, I like what UConn did this summer. You know, I'm a big driving space guy. That's one thing that I changed from taking over. You know, we're a four out, one in motion predominantly with a big at the block. You know, we kind of put him in the dunk spot now. And, you know, I studied Doug Novak. You know, if you know anything about Doug Novak and his driving space, I'm a big fan of it. You know, I'm a big fan of how he thinks about the game. You know, I think he's one of those guys that you don't hear as much about, but I think there's great wisdom and knowledge in everything that he brings to the table as a coach. And, you know, I'm continuing to get better at my craft in regards to the driving space. And, and just like I said, man, just little things that can hopefully incrementally make us better. So that's what Raul is doing right now.
What's one or two things that, without giving away all your secrets, what's one or two things that you're looking at that maybe you want to tweak from last year to this coming season?
Got to protect the paint a little bit more. That came with the youth. You know, that was the great thing about, you know, if you know anything about our past season, like we went 18-8, but I had probably a top five strength of schedule in the country. You know, 8 of the 13 non-conference teams I played ended up going to the national tournament, and 4 of those went to the Sweet 16, right? And we beat one of those. So we really challenged ourselves, but I did it with 6 freshmen. Like I played 6 freshmen this past year and I started 3 of them. And, you know, we got to get better on the defensive side of the ball, but that takes time, right? A lot of these guys, that takes about a year and a half, 2 years to really understand the consistency of staying in a stance, you know, coming from the weak side, you know, not over helping, you know, just knowing your role and what our philosophy is defensively. So I'm just, you know, protecting the paint is really important to us and getting out on shooters, just contesting a little bit more. I've gone to gap just because the college line has stretched out and you know, I just don't believe guys shoot it really well consistently. And we just got to become better at closeouts.
What's the biggest adjustment for a high school player defensively making the jump up to college in your mind?
Speed of the game, physicality of the game, you know, you're going from you're the top dog at 18 years old in most high school programs. We're now with COVID, with the transfer portal, you know, you're playing a lot of teams with 23, 24 year olds, right? It's grown men. And just the physical side of the game is just a little bit different. And you got to get used to that. And the only way to get used to that is, you know, bringing it every day in practice and playing at that speed consistently. So you can, when your opportunity does come in a game, that you can play at that level.
All right. When the kids get back to school and you're starting to eye October 15th. Now it's going to be different this year because you got your 8 days. You know what? Yeah. What do you do with your 8 days? You know yet?
My schedule's already planned. I wish we could start tomorrow, but it's already planned. You know, take it a little bit at a time. Incorporate the young guys. You know, we're going to take, you know, one practice a week, and then kind of, you know, go about 2 days and then 3 days as we get closer to October 15th, to kind of get them into, you know, for them to understand the grind of a college season. You know, we're typically practicing 6 out of the 7 days of the week, right? So they have to understand it. You know, it's 2-hour practices and there's film room and we're lifting and, you know, you're coming in and, you know, shooting with your partner. And there's a lot more to it now that you're in college, because you do have a little bit more time, right? You're not in class from 8 to 3 o'clock, right? You may have a class or two during the day. You may not have classes on a Tuesday and a Thursday, right? Like, so there's a lot of time if you want to become, you want to go from good to great as a player. There's time to do that. So, I think, you know, in those first early practices, it's just kind of getting our philosophy on both ends of the floor, starting with transition and probably with our defense and our ball screen stuff on what we're going to do and how we're going to go about it. So that's probably how we'll probably start those 8 practices.
How do you and your staff prepare for
those practices, and obviously that's something new, but just thinking about the opening day of practice, October 15th, what are you guys doing in the fall to get ready? Man, you got a lot of time to think about that first practice or that first week of practice or all the things you got to get in before the first game. What are those conversations like in the coach's office?
Yeah, you know, you say staff, you know, and I don't want people out there, if they do listen to this.
You got your 12, it's your, me. 12 yeah. your 12 guys you're meeting with?
Yeah, it's me and my guy, Jeff McCord, man. We were both teammates here. It's just me and him. We love it. You know, again, we're, you know, we take great pride in the program because we're both, number one, we're both teammates here. And we both went to the Sweet 16 and we want to get there again. It's just me and him, man. We actually met last week and we had a big board and we wrote, you know, what we need to get better at on the defensive side of the ball, you know, what we need to keep, what we need to throw out, what we need to include. And we're ready to go. You know, the playbook is set. You know, we just got to go about it day by day and hopefully get better. You know, I read the book Atomic Habits, man, and that's one thing that it talks about, you know, is trying to, you know, as silly as it may sound, getting 1% better in what you do, right? Incremental, you know, just upgrades in what you do. And if you can do that consistently, you're going to be a better team. And that's what I've challenged our guys with. You know, I want them to get 1% better in five different areas. And if we can all do that, the 12 guys that are returning, that makes us 60% better. That's kind of a Pat Riley thing. Pat Riley did that when he got to the Knicks. And, you know, it just empowers your guys to understand, man, like, you know, don't overdo it and think about, man, I got to score 4 or 5 more points a game. No, right. Let's just make this really simple. And if we can do that, you know, great things can happen as a team. So, yeah, man, everything is really, I'm big on that. You know, I like to be ahead of the game at all times, right? I'm not a last second type of guy and shooting from the hip type of dude. So, we're ready to go. If it's the season, they told us, hey, man, you guys can start tomorrow. The Scots are ready to go. That's for sure.
What's your best habit that you think leads to your success as a coach? What's your most important habit that's made you the coach that you are today?
Man, I don't believe in tough coaching. I believe you either love your kids or you don't, right? And if you love your kids, you're going to demand their very best. And, you know, I'm their harshest critic, but I'm also their biggest cheerleader. And, you know, I've taken that. That's been my philosophy my entire career from when I started as a 24-year-old as a high school head coach to now as a 41-year-old head coach in college. The more you love on your kids, you know, they talk about, you want to really push them, you know, in public, right? Like you want to really push the good that they're doing and the things that they're improving in, you know, really bring that out to them in public and in private, you know, talk about the things that they probably need to get better at. You know, I'm a big believer in that. And, but I think, yeah, I think the biggest thing is, man, I love them hard, man, you know, and, when you love somebody, you want them to be their very best. And again, you know, there's moments of, you know, it's uncomfortable moments sometimes, right? Between player and coach, but they know damn well that the only reason that I do that is because I want them to be the very best selves.
When you're in a practice setting and you're watching a drill or you're watching a scrimmage or whatever it is that you're working on at a particular time, this is a question I think is one that I've asked a lot of coaches, and I'm always just curious to how different coaches approach it and what their thought process is. When you see something that you need to correct, how do you go about correcting it? Is that something that, hey, we're stopping it immediately? Is it something that you have to be okay in this drill? We're focusing on this, but maybe we got to let this other thing slide within that. We want to keep the flow of practice going, but yet we want to be able to correct and coach in the process of doing it. So just how do you go about coaching your players during practice, if that question makes sense?
No, absolutely. I think you know, I'm a big follower of your podcast, by the way. I think you asked that to Coach Lutz, who was at, where is he now? Western Kentucky?
Yep.
And I think, you know, he responded it, you know, the same way I'm going to respond to you right now. Man, you really don't have, you know, if you're stopping that, you're stopping the flow of practice, right? If you're, you know, constantly saying, hey, man, you needed to go 2 dribbles to the right here. You know, I think you use the ability of what we have in today's game with the huddle cameras and the synergy and just the ability for them to be able to see it and the accessibility of today's cell phone, which they all have, and yeah, they're absolutely always on it, right? you know, it's a thing. I watch every single practice. I think that's how you get better, not only as a team, but you get better as a coach. You have about 100 plus of those a year while you only have 25 games, right? Guaranteed games. So you're going to get the most out of yourself as a coach and of your players by really dialing in and watching tape. And, you know, it takes 2 to 3 clips per kid. That doesn't take much time to do, honestly, between myself and the coach. We split the team in half. And we just, hey, man, like on this possession right here, you know, you probably should have gone over the top right here, you know, because we're hard hedging. You decided to go under and the guy popped a 3 behind the screen. Right. But instead of having to stop practice, you know, I just want practice to flow. And we can in an 8 to 12 minute film session, which I've gone to that now, you know, my coach really likes that. You know, that was one of the changes I made going into this year. Talk a little bit less in film. But, you know, and also the attention span of the player, right? I think an 8 to 12 minute film session, if you organize it correctly, your guys will get the most out of it, you know, and it could be 1 clip, 2 clips. Today was this guy's turn and we're just going to watch 8 minutes of this guy. Right. Like, but I think definitely I'd rather the practice flow than me stopping in every, you know,
right,
two possessions. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah, absolutely.
I've done that. I do this little thing where we do an out of bounds under play, right? We go into transition, and then on the way back, we're in a different type of defense, right? And the reason we do that, you know, we can take advantage of let's go over our out of bounds under play, let's do whatever we're doing in transition, let's do it correctly. And then on the way back, now you put 5 other guys out there and they could be in a 2-3 zone. They can be in a 1-3-1. They can pick you up 2-2-1 back to 2-3 or ban or whatever it is. And, you know, the guys are constantly understanding, man, I got to be thinking on the fly. Right. And so, you know, I rather, again, that goes back to flow. I really like the flow in practice more than me stopping and talking.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. I mean, I like the idea of making your players think, right? Because in a game, you got to think and be able to process. And you obviously can't call a timeout anytime a team changes defenses or throws something new at you that maybe you didn't expect. So, yeah, being able to have your players think on their feet is critical. When you're watching that film, are you doing it pre-practice? Is that when you guys watch that 8 to 12 minute film session?
You know, I started to do it, you know, and these are the things that probably people don't even think about, right? But like you don't, the cafeteria is only open from a certain time, right? So I got to incorporate, man, we're going to watch film after practice. If it's 5 to 7, is the caf going to be closed? You know, right. I want them to eat, you know, so this year we went to watching film before practice. You know, I'm going to incorporate, I heard my man Jason Zimmerman from Emory on the podcast talking about, you know, sometimes they may just play a quick 4-minute game. And then they go into the film room and kind of watch it and then come back to practice. Right. I love that. I love that. I've never done that. I think I may incorporate that this year. But yeah, we typically watch film before practice, you know, and, you know, if I want to get, you know, their attention sometimes, you know, we may have to watch it after practice. But for the most part, it's before and it's less. Honestly, that's one thing that I think I've gotten better at going into my 5th year. You know, just precise information that they need to know and not overload them with so much stuff, you know, just the keys of what we need to do. And obviously just, you know, concern ourselves with what we do well. If we do that, we give ourselves a chance to have a good chance to win in any game we play.
When you're looking at the film and you're going over and looking at a game and trying to analyze what happened, is there one or two stats, analytics, things that you like that you think are really key for your team, things that you maybe zero in on that are kind of a leading indicator for whether or not your team's going to be successful in a particular game or a particular season?
Yeah, I'll share, you know, some numbers with you. Anytime we shoot 45, 35, 70, so 45 from the field, 35 from three, 70 from the free throw line, I haven't lost a game in 4 years, wow. Right? So that's an important number for us. Rebound margin 4-8. I think at our level, I'm just talking about Division III. You know, right. That's the only thing I concern myself with. Exactly. That's the big time for me. 4-8. You know, we win a lot of. You know, we win at a high clip when we rebound 4-8 with a 4-8 margin. Steals and blocks. I think anything above 10 is good. You know, 12 is ideal because that means you're being very active. You know, you're probably averaging about 8-9 steals a game and probably about 2 or 3 blocks a game, right? So that's important to us. That tells me how active we've been. And then, you know, one stat that's really difficult to do, but we definitely track is you know, assisting on 50% of the made field goals, because that means everybody's touching it. The ball is moving. You know, it's not you just, you know, that's not one guy just scoring it, you know, and that's what we've prided ourselves for since coach's tenure, right? We got, you know, like this year we had 4 guys in double figure scoring, and then we had another 4 to 5, anywhere between 6 to 8 points a game. So, you know, valuing, you know, that extra pass and make it the right basketball player is important to us. And you know, I think some guys, you know, we call it kills. You know, getting 3 stops in a row is a kill. You know, my little student managers that help me that are really important as well. You know, I'm always asking at every media timeout, hey, man, how many kills we got, you know, to see how many stops and are we getting, you know, are we getting consistent stops through the flow of the game?
Your staff of 12 isn't able to do all that, right?
Hey, man, you know, that's why it's so important. Like, you're only as good as your, I mean this, as your assistant coach, because
so true.
Man, they do so much that, you know, and I'm so, you know, so blessed to have my guy. And, you know, we've been great friends for 20 plus years. And that's one of the reasons I think we're so successful as well, is we have great synergy between one another. You know, I'm the passionate one. I call him, you know, Jeff Whispers. You know, he's kind of my right-hand man. So he's Jeff Whispers. He just goes around and he's like, hey, man, real, you know, real quietly. And he's like, you really want to do this right, because you don't want pee on your tail, you know? So we have great balance between him and I, and man, we really enjoy it. But yeah, man, we wear so many hats, you know, from setting the hotels up to washing the jerseys to film to make sure you got the HDMI cord on the hotel trips. And because some hotels don't have HDMIs, and, you know, a lot of things that major programs don't really probably even concerns or have to deal with. You know,
they got an HDMI cord guy. There's one guy that's his only job.
Yeah. But I think that's why when Division III coaches are given the opportunity at the highest of levels, I think that's why they're so successful, because they've been able to do it all. And they're so ready for the opportunity, because there's nothing that is going to come their way that they have not done. So, you know, that's why I get so excited and happy for guys who get their Division I opportunity and then, you know, do a really good job. And then they get that next big opportunity, you know, from the Division III ranks, man. It makes me really happy, because I know how hard it is for us and all the things that we do.
Well, you get to touch all aspects of the program, right? Which is something that if you start at the Division I level, you don't necessarily get that same opportunity. I mean, a lot of guys that spend years and years, whether you're an ops guy or you're a video guy or whatever, and you may not even ever see the floor as a coach. And so it's interesting when you start talking about the different pathways that guys have to whatever coaching, whatever pedestal they want to get to. Eventually, there's lots of different ways to get there. And I think from just all the interviews that we've done with Division III head coaches, assistant coaches, coaches who have coached at the Division III level, I think that's the one thing that comes across more than anything else, is just the fact that, hey, my experience at the Division III level was I got to do everything that any coach could ever have to do. And I feel like all those guys feel that that's what propelled them in whatever they wanted to do in their career, whether they wanted to stay at the Division III level and find a job that fit them and find a community and a school that fits who they are. And that's what they wanted to do. And then other guys who want to move up in a level, everybody that we talk to just talks about how important that experience is, and just being able to do everything. And I think you would obviously concur with that.
Yeah. No. And another thing, you know, I heard this a long time ago, you know, you can know everything, but you can't do everything. And that's why I empower, just like I empower my players, my assistant coach is empowered to where, you know, there's certain things that he does and I don't even, you know what I mean?
Yeah,
I don't check up on it.
Yeah.
No, man. Like, because I want him to feel like, man, that's his thing. And, you know, he's in charge of it. And you know, and he has my 100% confidence that I know he's going to do a great job. So it's just, you know, it's part of it's a whole organizational thing. Like, I'm a big believer in that. Your president at the institution has to be bought in. Your athletic director needs to be bought in. Your trainer needs to buy in. Hey, I'm a big guy. Like, I got to feel good vibes about the bus driver. I got to know that my guy is all in. You know, we got that's a guy, right, yeah. Bobby Farmer. He's our guy. My man is like, he tells me all the time, hey, coach, I'm 29-2 when I'm your bus driver. I say, hey, Bobby, you just keep driving, brother. But yeah, man, I think it's an organizational thing. Everybody has to be on the same page and everybody needs to feel empowered that they can do their jobs to the highest of levels. And I think that's when organizations really, you know, reach great depths and can be their very best.
I love that, man. I love it. I think it's something that I think oftentimes is overlooked, but when you get everybody that's associated with the program, that's pulling in the same direction and everybody wants to see success, man, that's when you really can get things going, because we all know that that's not always the way it is everywhere. There's things that can get in the way of that, unfortunately. And when you do get everybody rowing that boat in the same direction, really good things can happen. I want to wrap up two part question. I'm sure you've heard it before. Part one, when you look ahead to what you have coming in the next year or two, what do you see as being your biggest challenge? And then the second part, when you think about what you get to do every day, what brings you the most joy? So your biggest challenge and then your biggest joy.
Man, biggest challenge is to not, you know, do not enter that land of complacency, right? And just continue to get better and continue to understand as coaches, as a staff, as players, that we haven't arrived, that we still got more things to accomplish as a team, as people, and that hopefully that never creeps in, you know, as a program, and that to continue to understand, you know, we have this simple little phrase where we talk about, you know, we always want to choose right over easy. You know, we always want to be connected instead of being isolated. You know, we want to always serve our community and not be selfish, you know, have extreme gratitude and not be entitled, you know, to focus on contributing and not complaining, you know, and to understand, which is now your final piece, right? Joy over pessimism. I enjoy, obviously, my wife, you know, and I think that goes without being said. Like, my wife is everything. You know, they put so much into it as your partner. You know, they sacrifice so much, and, you know, and I'm eternally thankful for her for that. You know, my daughter, you know, I miss a lot of, she's a really good soccer player, and I miss a lot of games and activities that she does because of the profession I do. But I think they understand, you know, why dad does what he does. And but I'm thankful for them. And so I, you know, I put myself in their shoes at all times and try to be around as much as I possibly can. So the joy of just being around them, you know, during the year and how they support me and they're at every one of my home games. And that gives me great joy, but also the joy of the hunt, man. You know, when you're hunting, that's where I take the most joy in, hunting down those goals and hunting down what we want to accomplish as a team. That gives me great joy. Not the final prize. It's kind of crazy when, you know, you go up and you cut those nets down or you get the ring, like, you know, it's a 2-minute thing, right? It's a 2-minute, 3-minute satisfaction, right? The thing that gives you the greatest satisfaction, man, is coming to work every day and trying to maximize yourself as a person, as a coach, because you are, you're a mentor to these guys and you're trying to empower them and give them the confidence that they can be leaders and coaches, whether they choose it or not, they're going to be coaching their families one day. And, you know, I take that part of my job so serious. So just the joy of knowing that the journey is, you know, it's hard and it's tough. But that's the joy of it, man. It makes you want it a lot. So that's what I really, really enjoy, is the hunt of the season.
Knowing what it takes to get there and having a support system in place that you can come home to, I think, man, there's nothing better than those two things. So that's really well said, Raul.
Man, I appreciate you, brother.
Absolutely. All right, before we get out, I want to give you a chance to share how people can connect with you, learn more about your program. So you want to share social media, email, website, whatever you want. And then after you do that, I'll jump back in and wrap things up.
My Twitter, it's at MC Coach Placeres, P-L-A-C-E-R-E-S. You know, that's a good way to follow myself, our program. You know, my cell phone number, 865-256-2222. If I can, you know, any coaches that, you know, hear the podcast that, you know, are interested in any stuff that we talked about or anything that I can help them out with, you know, reach out to me. You know, I love sharing the game with people. Man, that's really, you know, go to our website, mcscotts.com, and kind of go to basketball and kind of see everything that we're doing. But, man, that's how you find us. You know, if we're ever in town and, you know, as a high school coach or you got a player, always, man, that's the important part, players. If you got players, yeah, man, holler at us. But, again, man, you know, I'm an open book. Anything that I can share and help others with in their journey, that's why we do it. And I'll continue to be that way. So, man, I appreciate you because I think what you do is great because you cover so many different levels and so many different topics. And, man, it helps us coaches grow. And just not just being a coach, but being a person, the total package. So I truly appreciate you and your partner, Jay, for what you guys do.
Well, thank you. Kind words are always great to hear. And we don't take those lightly. Anybody that's taking the time out of their day to listen to what we have to say and for us to be able to give a platform to, again, coaches, as you said, at all different levels and different people that we've been in, fortunate enough to have on, that have been gracious enough to come out with us. I mean, it means the world to us. And the game of basketball is obviously something that has given me, I mean, just about everything in my life, I trace back to basketball in some way, shape, or form. So I feel like the pod is a small way for me to give back. And again, can't thank you enough for taking the time out of your schedule to jump on with us tonight, share your knowledge, and share what you've experienced throughout your journey. So kudos to you and thank you. And to everyone out there who's listening, we appreciate it, and we will catch you on our next episode. Thanks.
Thanks for listening to the Hoopheads podcast, presented by Head Start Basketball.